Hello, this is Chaz from Quiet Speculation, and you're listening to the QS Cast. If you're a QS subscriber, you're hearing this as soon as it gets published. If you're not a subscriber, you had to wait a few days. If you want to listen to the podcast as soon as it's published, or you just want to know more about Quiet Speculation, go to quietspeculation.com/tour and check out everything we have to offer. Hello, everyone. Good evening, and welcome to the QS Cast. Glad to have everyone here with us. Thanks for joining us tonight. We alluded to, you know, earlier in the week that we have an esteemed guest, well known in the Magic finance communities. Many of you do know him, some of you don't. But we're joined by Matthew. Some of you know him as Ogre, Matthew Ogre Stevens. Thanks for joining us, Matt. Pleasure to have you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Oh, and Tarkan's here too. But Ogre carved out some time for us. We have a lot of great topics. I think it's going to be great to have your insight. So again, really appreciate you giving us the time.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and apparently, Ogre, you were saying that no one has actually called you by your real name in several years. Pretty much now, like, the world knows you as Ogre, right?
As a day-to-day, I'm certainly called Ogre. There's I stopped at my dad's house earlier today, and I think he might have called me Matt.
It's funny because, so I mentioned to Chaz, I'm like, hey, Chaz, you know, we're going to have Ogre on. I said, let's be, like, appropriate, and, you know, I don't know how many people actually call him Ogre, so let's just, you know, call him Matthew on the cast, and then you're like, everybody knows me as just Ogre.
It just feels weird, honestly, at this point.
Yeah, and so I mean, we try to be, like, you know, as formal as we can, but as we go along, I mean, we have no problem. Abiding by the wishes of our guests. So, by all means, I mean, so yeah, we have a pretty great cast lined up. We have a lot to kind of delve into here, so we're going to kind of try to give as much time as we can to this. I know some folks definitely tuning in. We got a lot of folks kind of tuning in. You know, when we're all talking, I mute myself. I'm kind of going to, you know, have folks, you know, send out the message. More folks will probably listen in because there's a lot to, you know, a lot of people want to pick your brain, Ogre. So I think you can shed some light on a few things here.
Sure.
Yeah, yeah. hopefully we have a pretty extensive Q&A session, like, towards the end. We'll just open the floor, and a bunch of people want to ask questions. So anything we don't cover, obviously, we can talk about. But, you know, I'm stoked to have you on, man, because we didn't actually meet in person until, I think it was actually just here. It was the first time I actually met you. But, like most people, I'd heard about you, man, and you were kind of I don't want to say an enigma. But for years, I had just heard of the guy Ogre, and I didn't go around to events much when I was younger. I mean, I went to some, but, you know, you just kind of hear your name, and so I'm like, wow, I finally met you, and we have you on, so it's really cool. And so I guess, you know, a lot of people, probably similar to myself, like, they may have heard your name in passing, or maybe they haven't heard of you at all. But I think it'd be cool if you could just kind of intro kind of what you do, what you've done, kind of the history of you in trading, because you are a floor trader, and some people really aren't familiar with what that is. So maybe you can tell us, kind of give us, like, a background of your story.
So I've been doing this for probably close to 20 years, 15 if you consider, like, really actually traveling and going to show to actually trade and gain value. I think I started off my trading career was 99. I think I went to Origins. And I went to the Origins Game Fair, which is at that time, I think it was like 20,000 person, maybe somewhere between 20 and 40,000 people went to that show. And I think I stayed up all but 3 hours of the 3 or 4 day show and just traded. Originally, I started trading just to help my, I had a small team of players. Like, we would go to PTQs and we'd go all over the Midwest, and they would need cards for decks, or they would need just stuff for fun decks. But most of the time I completed their tournament decks. And then I would play also, and sometimes I do good, but most of the time I just want to sit around and trade because it gained our collection value and also helped complete decks. And I went from there to bigger tournaments. I have a few top eights in PTQs when they were just regular PTQs. I have, I think, four constructed and four limited. There's a Grand Prix I showed up to once, and at the Grand Prix, there was no trading going on, so I decided to sign up, and I got top 32 in that. It was pretty fun. I don't know. Where else should I go from here?
So I guess, you know, when people hear floor traders, obviously people that have been in the finance community or in the industry and on the business side know what that is. But like maybe you can break down just the fundamentals of what it would entail a floor trader and how you actually, you basically turn that into a profession. And some people are like, wait a minute, like the guy trades, you know, as a living? Like, yeah. So maybe you can kind of explain like that whole process, how that sort of, how that evolved.
Sure. You can go in a lot of different levels, basically. You can start off with almost nothing and then trade like pack to power style, or you could show up with a huge binder with everything you could, you know, other people could want. And basically all you're doing is trying to find cards that other people need for their decks or for their collections and gain them the value of getting that card instantly or faster than they would normally. And then in return, you're trying to gain a little bit of basic value. So let's say that I had a $40 card that somebody really wanted, and they had a bunch of $3 and $4 cards that equaled maybe $50 or $60, depending on what they wanted, if they didn't need them or whatnot. They would love to trade that $40 card for a bunch of $5 cards or smaller cards. I gain a little bit of value along the way, and they basically get to use me as though I'm a 7-Eleven.
Fascinating. So now how do you take a, like you said, you know, obviously people heard the term pack to power, but how do you start with like literal nothing and then get to the point you can do this, you know, how does this translate into paying bills, we'll say, or how do you turn this into kind of a job?
So as far as turning into a job, you have to find your outlets, like the people that want to buy certain things. So what I've done is I've established over 15 years, just an immense amount of outlets. I know who wants what, but I know who wants what for actual dollars, not necessarily just cards. There are tons of companies out there that pay really good percentages on cards. So if a card's worth $8 retail, they'll pay up to six, I've seen, you know. If you get lucky, maybe you can find, you know, a local person that will pay eight. But I generally just do more of a just overall. So I'm happy getting rid of my $8 card for five if I can do it every day all the time. But just like I said earlier, was if I have a $40 card and you give me $50 in value for it, even if they're smaller cards, I will find the outlet to make the percentage overall better and turn it into cash by selling those cards to vendors or bigger stores.
Yeah, so it's really interesting. So you basically live in that spread area where, you know, you're going to be trading at retail value for, you know, maybe even a few percentage points, maybe 10% or whatever. And then, you know, over the course of an event, you'll have compounded that essentially, and you'll just cash it out, right? Is that basically how it works?
Right. So yeah, exactly. If I had at the beginning of the show, if I started out with only a $50 card, I would break it down multiple times. So I'd break it down into like maybe three $20 cards and then make those $20 cards, and I'd break those down into maybe like eight $10 cards, and I would just consistently break that down throughout the entire event. Sometimes you break it down to the point to where you get nothing but bulk rares. And then at that point, you can still use those bulk rares. You can go sell them off to a vendor and then actually re-up your cash. Like bulk rare market is very, very abysmal at this point, but you can still find people that'll buy them. And then at the end of the day, the vendors buy your cards at the end of the show possibly, and then you go back home on the way home, spend that money, and re-up your collection, buying stuff at half or close to that or whatever you can efficiently.
So this, I mean, it's pretty amazing. And you were kind of one of the, I don't want to say pioneer of, I mean, trading for value has been a thing, but as far as like floor trading, you know, kind of take us back. Are you, as far as I know, you're kind of one of the first, we'll say OG floor traders that was really doing it on a serious level, you know, back in the early 2000s.
There's certainly a level before me. Like Jim Brusso was probably the first person that I recall being like the floor trader, like prior to myself. And I'm sure there are other people that I don't know from that era. It would be awesome if somehow we could get him on this call too. That would be fun. That would be neat. But I don't know how that works.
So,
but yeah, but I've been around as long, like only a few more years than, or a few fewer years than him, and it's been a long ride. So,
yeah, and I mean, you know, you were doing it before the cell phone era. So I guess the next natural question is, what was the scene like before cell phones, and then how did you evolve the model, or how did floor chairs evolve the model once the cell phone era, you know, when everyone was just firing up prices on their phone? How did that?
So technology makes people lazy. Even myself. So prior to cell phones, I actually, the way I originally learned how to figure out the prices of cards is I just looked in Scry. So you look in Scry, you evaluate and figure out what the prices are. Then I went to a show, that same Origins show, and I tried to sell the collection that I had picked up in Scry. And I got a rude awakening from, not the card, but an actual rude awakening from arriving to a vendor at the show. And he told me that my Foil Destiny set that I had just completed was not worth the few thousand dollars that I wanted, but only, I think, a few hundred he offered me. And then I kind of realized that you need to go about it a little different. You need to find out what the people will actually pay for before you acquire the cards, so that you know what you're going to get out of the cards when you get there. As far as the technology part is, if you can just constantly remember all the cards, which takes forever, but as a day-to-day, just like in any job, if you do it all the time and you're passionate about it, you're going to learn those numbers no problem.
So you basically memorized the price of, I don't know, we'll say a large portion of cards that have any meaningful value that are out there. If not
over a dollar, at one point in time in my life, I could recite the price within 10% easily.
That's incredible. So then, you know, would you be transparent when you would sit down? Would you say, hey, listen, I'm going to do a trade, but I'm going to want, you know, some value on my side, since I'm giving you exactly what you need right now. I'm going to want to take your junk for a few extra percentage points. Like, is that how the conversation would go? Because, you know, back in the day, you know, as just a kid that would go every once in a while, I was always scared that someone's going to try and rip me off, or, you know, people weren't going to tell, because that, you know, unfortunately that was pretty rampant back then, right? Like, there was a lot of guys running around just sort of like, you know, not being honest with people and not telling them, you know, not being, because, you know, I couldn't look up stuff, you know, before. And so was that kind of the classy thing to do, is you'd sit down and you'd say, listen, you know, I'll trade you, you know, X, but I'm going to want a few extra, you know, a little bit of extra value out of it.
Sure. So I've been on both ends of the spectrum, just like everybody. The way to learn is to fail, right? So one of my first transactions was, I think I traded away a gemstone mine for a wasteland, where I got the gemstone mine, because I had no idea. I didn't know anything at all, you know. As far as the way that I trade and the way other people trade, my trades generally start out with me acknowledging and informing you of what I'm doing. Because if you don't do that and you sit down, you end up looking like a fool when they're like, what do you mean your cards are worth different, you know, prices than mine, and we're looking at the same number? So you have to establish some kind of, not necessarily dominance, but I think that's kind of what it is. Establish that you're the person that's there to offer them a service of getting them what they want, but you're also trying to get what you want. And I'm very transparent whenever I deal with anybody. I'm very open with information.
And I mean, that was, you know, back in the 90s, that was probably something that was pretty, people were probably like pleasantly surprised, at least, okay, well, hey, he's being completely straight up with me. But then over time, as I said, we went into the mobile generation, the mobile era, and where everyone knew the value of their cards. So did it become harder? Like, did floor trading, I don't want to say the technology made it more difficult, but everyone was savvy on prices, and everyone knew that guys like you existed, you know, became common knowledge. As well as everyone else is trying to get more value for their cards. So what was the era like in the, I guess, the 2000s, you know, through, I guess, you know, the turn of 2000?
The Wild West.
Yeah, like, did I mean, more floor traders came into the scene, I guess, and then did it become more difficult?
Well, think of it like this. I mean, more floor traders came into the scene as the game grew, you know.
Right.
Everybody says it became more difficult, but in reality, whenever I dealt with somebody with a phone, I actually have them do the work for me, because I don't know all the prices all the time, and we can be more accurate, which is great. But as long as you inform them or let them know that what your plan is to, you know, I want to acquire some value, and you're nice about it. Generally, you make them laugh beforehand and get to know the person that you're trading with. As long as they're okay with it, then, you know, they're going to get what they want. But the thing that you bring up, basically the Wild West before cell phones, there was a lot more of that chance and possibility of the person misleading, and there was nobody to look to tell you whether it was right or wrong.
Interesting. So yeah, so basically, you know, with information readily available, in some ways you could reframe it that it became a little easier in that, you know, we both know everything's on the table now, right? All right. The information's available. I'm telling you what we're doing here. And, you know, I mean, and I've watched you engage in trades. I've seen other floor traders, and most people, you know, they're trying to find an out to get cards they want. And you're probably willing to give them more trade value than the vendors were at the time. I'm assuming that's the case, right? Because, you know, you guys were kind of competing with the floor traders in a sense. And I'm assuming you guys just kind of offered, you guys were like, you know, just offering better trade value than a large entity would be able to do because, you know, they have costs, et cetera.
Can I just jump in?
But it's not necessarily always true on both ends. Everybody uses what they can to either gain value or work the system to the point where they, you know, see fit. There are some vendors I've seen a vendor give more retail value on an item than he sold it for based on their hot list and the bonuses. So, you know, I definitely couldn't give you 105% on a card, you know, and that's so they take it back so they can sell it for cash, or maybe their percentage is just weird and they give a whole lot of trade bonus where when I'm trading, I don't have to give a trade bonus because I'm always trading. So it's depends on what person, you know, you're dealing, like who you are. Like I could give 50% on something, or I could give 80%, depending on whether or not I want it either. And sometimes it's harder to sell certain things, so I wouldn't be able to give more than a vendor that's out of stock. And that's also my choice, whether or not I want to do that or not. So it's not anything that's written in for sure, you know?
I just wanted to jump in with a quick question for you, Ogre. I mean, you know, Tark brought up a great point, and, you know, you're explaining this so well that, like, you're kind of just there as this kind of place that, like you just said, you know, it's different for every person what they, you know, what they want. And, you know, I would assume that, you know, and we're talking that the kind of consensus is things have gotten so hard and we've jumped, you know, from the Wild West to people having these, you know, phones and able to, you know, look up all these prices. But at the same time, I mean, could you talk about, at least back then, I mean, I was like, you know, an early teenager where, you know, there wasn't a lot of information. But at the same time, even when information became more readily available, there were other avenues that also popped up that kind of gave you more outs to having what people want, because you have to remember that back then there wasn't avenues like Pauper and Commander and all these different things that people suddenly want all these different cards for. So that at the same time, like, did some things make it easier, but then, you know, those kind of aspects canceled it out a little bit?
So as far as canceling out, like you, the more options allow me to trade something from somebody that somebody doesn't want and find somebody that does want it easier. Absolutely. I don't focus on Pauper so much unless it's foil, because there's not a whole lot of value there. But
right,
as far as EDH is insane, our Commander just almost allows every card to, you know, be desired, no matter how bad it is sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, because I brought that up because if it was just that everyone got phones and we were still, I mean, like back then, I mean, we had cards. I mean, you look back on it, I mean, I don't think people remember that, you know, Call of the Herd was like a $20 card at one point.
Yep.
And, you know, it's crazy to think about, but, you know, people knew why it was a $20 card, but there wasn't a lot of information out there that if you, you know, not a lot of people would know that it was that price. I mean, even Spiritmonger, you know, cards like that. So there was a lot, you know, as we kind of grew into the, you know, mobile phone age and, you know, all this information became more readily available, you know, people don't realize that there were so many more avenues to the game that did open up. I mean, it would have probably been near like, maybe not impossible, but really, I mean, scraping thin if we just kind of gotten to this age and everything stayed status quo. I mean, like I said,
you play spades. Just go play spades at that point.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, so I kind of wanted to bring that up because people don't really realize that they want to always just kind of go back to, well, you know, things, you know, I don't know how, you know, people like Ogre do it or how like people kind of evolved with this, you know, people everything looking up on TCG. You have to realize that the game kind of grew even with that technology. And, you know, a lot of people are assuming, yourself included, you know, you kind of just alluded to it that, you know, it was good that it did that because if we stayed the same and, you know, everything was on the phone, it would make things extremely difficult. So there's so many more ways to, you know, be that person that, you know, when they come to you and they need something, okay, well, now I have all these cards for Commander that I didn't, you know, wasn't even a thing back then.
Right.
Well, and that's the thing, Chaz, like you're saying. I mean, Ogre, you're basically, you're a one-stop shop, right? I'm assuming. I mean, I guess your mantra is similar to most vendors, where you're like, I just need to make sure I have everything or have most as much as possible that somebody would want, right?
Right. So the cool thing about having so many floor traders at a show is somebody knows somebody that has something, right? So if I go to a show and there's 20 or 30 people that I would acknowledge as a floor trader, and there's 15 vendors, amongst all those people, if you walk in that room, you're going to be able to find the card if you ask for it. So let's say that there's not 20 or 30 floor traders. Now there's nobody that gives incentive to go out and find that card that you want. So now you walk into the room and you're like, I want a Beta Soul Ring. They, you know, clearly a vendor might have it, but if they don't have it and there's 20 floor traders, one of the floor traders is going to know one of the other ones, and they're going to be able to easily get you the card.
So what's the biggest trade? This is kind of an aside. What's the biggest trade that you sat down with someone? And let's do player first. Then maybe you've done a trade with vendors, but what's the biggest player trade in one session? And did it go on for 4 hours or something like that?
I'm sure I've had plenty of 4 hour trades. The biggest one I think was, I acquired a collection like a week before this trade, and then I didn't have time to go to a show until I did the trade. And then I picked up the collection. Half of the collection was 25,000. And then I ended up trading, I think, 10,000 out of it the next time I got to sit down. And it was a bunch of foreign foil Japanese fetch lands. I think it was a set of Deltas, a set of Strands, and some other fetch lands. But it was, and then like three or four weeks later, you know, like the cards all go up in value, which is pretty awesome. I can't, like, putting me on the spot with this, I'm sure there's plenty more. I've definitely traded quite a bit of really big trades. Those are the fun trades, the ones that basically it's impossible to get outside of a Grand Prix, because there's not, you know, everybody coming to the same spot to be able to trade.
So basically, over $25,000 you've traded in one, like just sitting down in front of a guy in card.
That specific trade was a $10,000 trade, but over the course of that weekend, it was easily $25,000 in trade.
Well, I would assume over the course of a weekend, I mean, you probably, I don't know, maybe have you hit close to like six figures, you know, over the span of the entire event, you know?
So I also have people that trade for me. And with the entire group, I'm sure that the total transactions, it was four people at GP Vegas three or four years ago when the first Modern Masters came out. I'm almost certain that me and three people did over six figures in trading. Not really in value gained, clearly not in value gained, but in trading for
just
sure.
Like we'll say like overall sales, we'll call quote unquote sales or trades, the same thing as like gross sales. Like you grossed, you know, over six feet. That's incredible, man.
There was one show I went to. It was Gen Con. I think it was 4 or 5 years ago. And I ended up chaining purchases into over $100,000, starting out with 25. That was pretty awesome. I was working for a company called Ivory Tower that weekend. But it wasn't, you know, it was, I bought a collection. I then used that collection kind of as a collateral thing. I went to Detroit from Gen Con, bought an Alpha Beta Unlimited Antiquities Arabian Nights Legends set, and then came back to Gen Con and sold it all. I think that was my biggest overall transaction when it comes to Magic cards.
Amazing. So actually, you brought up a really interesting point, which was, you know, working with vendors. So first, I want to address a rumor that has always gone around, and people claim it's true. People claim it's false, especially the people that were apparently involved claim it's false. But there's stories that vendors back in the day, this doesn't happen now, obviously, it hasn't happened recently, to my knowledge, would hire floor traders, not necessarily specifically yourself, but they would kind of set up agreements with floor traders to kind of go out and work for them on a soft sort of backdoor commission deal, without being exact. Like, you know, for example, we'll say X vendors, like, hey, you know, you guys go trade for me. You don't have to say you're with us. You're not employees of us, but, you know, and then you guys would come back. Is there truth to that? Like, did that, you know, go on frequently, or is that sort of?
That seems incredibly vague and pretty easy to do. So I can't imagine there's not truth to that, but I don't, like, I think they made a rule even before I was, I guess, into the game that much, that vendors weren't allowed to put floor traders on the floor like that. So I don't know many people that have that particular kind of arrangement.
Okay, cool.
Actually, I don't know anybody I can name right now.
Well, that's good. Well, so anybody who is thinking about that, it's coming from Ogre that generally does not really.
I'm certainly not saying that it could not happen, because it just makes sense that seems easy, you know.
Right.
But then again, it's the same kind of thing without without saying. I mean, so I would go to a Grand Prix and I wouldn't work for vendors, but I would sell to all of the vendors, you know. Does that make me sitting on the floor trading for stuff, you know, gaining value there, working for them? No, but it's the same kind of concept, isn't it?
Well, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, it was, you know, people would say, oh, you know, this, you know, they're specifically working with this entity, or they're exclusively working with this, which, and as you said, I mean, look, at the end of the day, floor traders were working for everybody, right?
Right?
If you break it down the logic, that's what they're doing.
I like to use the term, like, I've worked with, but not for, you know. So I don't work for anybody, but I have worked with almost everybody at a Grand Prix.
And so to that point now, I mean, exactly. You've had tons of experience. Actually, now you have actually worked, like, you've been staffed for with different companies before, right?
Yeah, I've worked behind the
booth. How did that work? Like,
probably 25%.
Like, how did you transition? I guess, or
what?
Oh. I don't know if we lost Tarkan right there.
Oh, lost somebody.
Probably lost Tarkan, but no, you cannot be heard, and I think you muted yourself. Tark out, yeah.
Can I be heard now? Am I better now?
Yeah, there we go. Okay. You're back.
Sorry about that, guys. So yeah, I guess what I'm curious about is, you know, did the vendors basically, you know, kept, you know, they caught you, you know, you caught their eye. They're like, wow, you're really good at this. Why don't you come, you know, kind of work for us on a commission basis or part-time, or how did that work?
Right. So where do we start? So I've worked, well, I have actually been employed by Troll and Toad for 3 years, about 6 years ago. And I've had my own store before I was employed by Troll and Toad. They actually kind of headhunted me, and I had a store in St. Louis called Ogre's Games. And that was a long, fun thing to do. Trying to think of the first person. I don't think I was put behind a booth. I think originally I would put myself behind a booth, and then I think Troll and Toad, the first person that I got to be behind a booth with, like at more of a professional level. Let's say like a Grand Prix would be a professional level. And then past that, I've worked with Pink Bunny Games, Hot Sauce, Power Nine, there's so many more that aren't popping in my head right away. I've been behind a lot of booths.
Do you enjoy being a buyer for a company more so than doing your own thing?
So it's a lot of different. So doing your own thing is a lot of responsibility, because you have to come up with the, at this point, $6,000 venue or table fee, and the extra $3,000 to $4,000 worth of staffing and travel and expenses. Being behind a booth for somebody, you don't have to worry about that. You just show up and you work your, you know, 60 hours in a four or five day weekend, and then, you know, sleep, no sleep, and wake up and do it again. So it is more fun, I think, to work for somebody because there's less risk and less stress.
But less reward, right? I mean, I'm assuming that, you know,
potentially less reward. So if you, I've been on shows where I technically worked for somebody, but still it was the entire show was mine and I've lost money before. And I've been to those shows and I've made $4,000 before, you know, after splits and costs of everything. As far as the company, I'm sure the company made plenty of money after they got everything in and the buy list they wanted. But there are also definitely risks the way that I was set up. And then sometimes I will subcontract myself out for a flat fee, which is a lot easier. Not as many risks. But like you said, not as much reward potential.
But now you just said a little earlier ago that you also had kind of like a team of people under you. I mean, you essentially had or had your own small floor trading enterprise in a sense, right? Like you had, I guess, like we'll call them employees.
Sure.
How does explain that structure? Like, you know, when somebody thinks, how did Ogre like hire a fleet of traders? How can you explain that model?
Sure. Now that it doesn't matter at all, I'm pretty sure. So the way that it works is you would show up, let's say you would show up to an event and I would give you a book. You'd have a binder. It's worth about $10,000. Then you would trade all weekend long and then you would come back. And now the book's worth $13,000. And then I would then give you a percentage of the gain that book was worth. So depending on, you know, what that number was, I think I've had guys make him anywhere between 500 and one guy at one show made $3,000 based on that model.
So it's a commission model, and
that's incredible.
It's like sales. It's like salespeople, and you're just incentivizing them.
That's pretty much what it is.
Sales position, basically.
Yep.
Amazing.
Man.
Amazing. All right. Well, so that's kind of this is basically floor trading. Trading in a nutshell, and we probably have questions that are later, but let's pivot to the biggie, which is where we're at now. Channel Fireball, they announced the policy, floor trading is quote unquote dead. No more floor trading is allowed. I mean, that this whole scene is now just kind of put to rest as far as the policy is concerned.
Right.
So the first question is, you know, what was your response and others in the community's response to the policy change, and where, you know, what are we looking at moving forward?
So can I cuss on this thing, or I'm not sure?
We'll allow you one, but we're normally PG.
you can have one.
Well, I would use it in this if I felt like it was necessary, but so it sucks. Like, it's really unfortunate because I don't just look at it as like a form of income. I look at it as like basically my entire social life is at those events. You know, like every person that I've developed a relationship in the last 16 years go to those events constantly. And it's really sad for, I think, the community overall, especially the community that I'm so ingrained in. But as far as like business will go on. You have to evolve and just do what you feel is the next step. In my case, my next step is to, I'm going to start traveling to different locations and acquiring more product instead of leading my team of traders. One of my traders decided to start working with one of the booths because he's very competent and he can just, you know, walk on to basically any sales position at any of the booths. Another one is focusing more on what he's doing at home. He runs his own TCG account and he'll just sell more cards. I have more time to focus on that because, you know, going out every weekend was absorbing most of his time and giving him enough money to do whatever he wanted. And then I brought on a new guy and I'm going to train him to go from store to store to store and buy bulk and help stores liquidate their overflow. So that's my direction.
So in essence, you're not really going to be, and by the way, really quick, when you say travel shows, Ogre, you've traveled literally coast to coast, right? I mean, I think like you hit like all I would say, how many of the shows you hit a year? Like 70%?
If there were 50 shows in a year, I probably hit 40 of them. I've also traveled to Costa Rica, Japan, Spain, Canada, Mexico. Like I've been all over the, you know, quite a bit of the places in the world doing this. I'm interested. I don't know if they've actually banned or restricted trading outside of the U.S. If it's just a U.S. rule, Anybody know that?
I know in Japan, I think it's definitely not a thing. It hasn't.
Yeah, Japan's
weird.
You
weren't allowed to trade in Japan for.
They've already done that. That was like a few years ago, I think.
Yeah. You know, I'm currently based in Southeast Asia, working with QS and Ion, and they don't have any events out there, but when they do, it's usually not an issue. Like I talked to a guy who floor trades he's a grinder in Australia, and so he did, I think it was GP Brisbane or whatever. So I think out here, but again, they have an event like once a year in this region.
Sure.
I think Europe is, to my understanding, it's still fine, but I can't really give a qualified answer to that. I'm not sure,
right.
But I think it's okay. They still do it over there. I'm not sure.
I'm sure.
But the thing is though, CFB is taking over the whole. They got the show. So this is their policy everywhere now, right? So I mean, in essence, it's kind of done, right? Like,
yeah.
I mean, this is their official flat policy across the board, and they're running all the shows. So I mean, I'm taking it as just floor trading is over.
I mean, so floor trading to gain value technically is the thing that's over. Something that I've, you know, clearly I've been watching this as close as possible. Apparently, if you go to floor trade not for value, there are still trades happening. It's just if you scare off, or if you know the majority of floor traders just aren't there, there's just not going to be a lot of action happening. And I know a guy who always straight trades, like. He's a guy out of Canada, and he always straight trades, and he writes everything down. But he trades like he'll do some monstrous trades. So I imagine that they would still keep an eye on something like that too. But I don't know. As since they have banned it, I haven't actually been to an event because I just don't want to spend thousands of dollars to go to an event to not do it, not be able to do what I prefer and what I find fun. You know?
Right. And where's the cutoff for trading for value, right?
Yeah, like who determines what that is, you know? And that's the thing is, I don't think that that's the rule, you know? If that was the rule, then there wouldn't be a question. It wouldn't be a problem because they wouldn't be looking for that. There's something that's got to be deeper than just that, you know?
I think to me, it seems like the surface reasoning is that, well, you know, we have more, you know, we have more vendors, and we've opened the door to more vendors, and we want the business to go straight to the vendors. At least that's the surface. Like, we don't want to be taking, you know, we don't want to be taking business away. And, you know, I mean, there have been, and I've seen this, you know, so I've seen guys, I don't even know who they were, but I'll see guys who do trades and they walk outside the hall and they exchange cash, you know what I mean? Which is not really the sad, you know, that's not the classiest thing to do, but you know, so I think they just, again, the surface reasoning is that, well, we want all the business to go just to the vendors.
Sure. Sure. My, I guess my rebuttal to that is, the floor traders, some of them will acquire cards all weekend long and then just go to the vendors and sell them all.
Yeah. I mean,
the cards that
I was just going to say, baby, I mean, Ogre pretty much said it before. If you have the vendors in mind, I mean, at the end of the day, you have the floor traders like Ogre giving all the business to the vendors pretty much anyway. So at the end, like, they're still making out. Like, they end up getting majority of the cards anyway.
All right.
It's very weird. I mean, I don't – we had CFB on, actually, Ogre. I don't know if, you know, you should probably go back and listen to it for anyone else that – hasn't heard that vendor cast, and you know, I don't want to really, you know, say anything because I'd love to have them back. So this is kind of, you know, it's kind of a hard spot, but I'm kind of shocked and a little disappointed that, you know, when I heard this, because they didn't give any indication that they would make these kind of drastic changes. I mean, they were, you know, from what I remember, Tark, I mean, they were on with us and they were very adamant about keeping, you know, for the most part, the status quo of when they kind of took on this whole big role about GPs. And we had a lot of people or a lot of insiders rather in this channel, you know, when they were in here, because I mean, it was a big thing. And, you know, I was very surprised that they made this move.
I can say this. I can say this confidently in sitting in meetings with like John Sounso and those guys. Like, they are very passionate about encouraging just player trades. fans. Like they genuinely want to do that. You know, the sense that I've gotten, and again, I wasn't any of these conversations regarding this policy, but you know, there was, as the shows have gotten bigger and there's been more shows, there's just a, you know, there's part of it is a lot of cash being exchanged under the table. You know, as David mentioned here in the chat, the costs are going up, so they want the vendors to feel like they're really getting the most value, and they're able to come in and do the business that they can. But I can definitely say that, you know, when it comes to core player trading, they want to do that. I mean, there was at one time there was these very brief, you know, conversations or ideas being thrown around. But what if there was a actual trading booth where players and trade. Yeah, right. Yeah, so, you know, I mean, I can say again, just from very limited and conversations I've had, that they present themselves as being, you know, wanting to serve the trade community. They think it's a core part of the game, but there was just, you know, I guess clearly they felt that there was issues going on with the value stuff and the people that were doing it for profit and for business.
Sure. So I think that it, as far as Channel Fireball, I think they're an amazing company. Like, I actually deal with them a lot. I think they're doing what they think is the best for the overall community. And I'm on one end of the spectrum. So, like, I have, you know, it's hard for me in general because, I mean, I know where I stand when it comes to trading. You know, clearly I want to do it because it benefits me the most. I think that it would have been really interesting to, instead of try to make something smaller, to amplify it, to possibly like make a specified area and give a little bit of more space for the encouragement of trade, period. Not a specific kind of trade, but just trade in general. I think that would have been phenomenal. But again, that's, you know, maybe that's, I wouldn't say it's agreed, just I think that making something bigger is better than making something smaller.
Yeah, I mean, imagine if you had literally a section off, you know, a booth, and it was like the, you know, the CFB trade booth, and you came up there, and it could be monitored in however way or managed or whatnot, but, you know, people could line up, they could go to a booth. I think that would be really interesting, you know?
I'm not necessarily thinking that it should be a booth. I think it should just be an area. You know how you have an area to eat, and there's a bunch of round tables? Just sure, have an yeah. area where there's trade. As far as the trade booth for CFB or for any of the vendors, I mean, that's what their booths are. You know, they would just be giving themselves more space, which is great. I think, I personally think from the other end, you know, being behind a booth constantly is, you know, more booth space would be awesome for the amount of money that it costs to run one.
So I guess, Ogre, you know, what is, I know you mentioned some of your buddies are going to go work with other entities or do their own thing. What are you going to do, man? I mean, you're one of the big guys. How is your business evolving, I guess?
So, have you ever heard of Darium's Pokemon?
Absolutely. Yep.
Okay.
He was big in Magic for a while.
Quite big on the internet. Well, his Magic channel has like 40 or 45,000 people. His Pokemon channel has 340 or 350,000 people. And I've been talking to him about potentially working with him on the acquisition of Pokemon cards. I believe that if I maybe were in some of his videos and then went to a Pokemon event instead of being, you know, shown up and being looked at funny or, you know, want to not be there, I would show up and people would actually encourage me to show up and be there. So I think it might be a more inviting community for what I do, which is, you know, find people's stuff they need.
So what you're basically saying is we might see you move away from Magic for a bit, would be unfortunate.
I would still be acquiring stuff the way I normally do, which is from, you know, stores and just collections, you know, outside in the real world where you can just do whatever you want. But I would probably start focusing on that so that I could, you know, be not restricted to anything. I might also, I mean, there's always that possibility of trying to acquire a booth at a Grand Prix. But in my opinion, it's really hard and there's a lot of risk and it requires a lot of financing to make sure that you can do it properly. And then the off chance that even if you have all of that stuff, you know, you don't get a big collection or you don't sell enough stuff, still is a, you know, there's still a risk there.
So do you think that these change, you know, besides the, you know, obviously you have a social community and these guys that would come and be outlets for trades and be, you know, guys would have cards and this whole community aspect. Do you think this is going to have sort of longer term effects just on the general GP ecosystem?
Yeah, I mean, you have to. Think about like a regular ecosystem. If you eliminate the things that clean up all the little stuff, you know, a lot of stuff happens. I don't know what it'll be or how it's going to specifically happen. But if there aren't traders there to get the hot list cards to bring over to the vendor that's buying the hot list cards that wants to bring 100 copies of the best card home, it's likely that they'll just sit into the binders of those people that have them and they'll just stagnate because those people don't have time to go stand in a line to sell one copy. When one of my guys or a trader or a floor vendor in any way or whatever acquires those cards and then make sure to get the copies to the people that want them the most via the people that have it the highest buy list.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with you. And you know, it's not like, you know, as we said, you guys were working with these guys, right?
Yeah, it's generally a symbiotic relationship. Like
subcontractors, right? And now, you know, they're kind of just having to step behind the booth and hopefully they market themselves correctly and they get enough people. And like you said, I mean, especially like CFB, you go to an event, sometimes the CFB line is just down the hall, you know?
It shows they're an awesome company. I mean, they have great prices and, you know, they're going to continue that, I'm sure.
So you had mentioned, I kind of want to touch on this really quick. You had mentioned you had a store, which is really interesting because you have this whole separate career as a, you know, traveling, doing shows and floor trading, but then you owned a store at one point. So I'm very curious to hear how you found those two experiences.
Okay. So the store was in St. Louis, Missouri. It's called Ogre's Games. I opened it for, I think it was 2009, and then I ran it for about a year. I originally opened it because I was supplying, I think, 5 stores in the St. Louis area with some singles at a very small amount, like nothing compared to what like a store needs. But one day, my girlfriend told me that she wanted all the cards out of the house because, you know, there was a lot of cards in the house. So I decided that I wanted there to be a spot to have all those cards. So I opened a small storefront. It was like 400 square feet, or no, $400 for like 600 square feet in St. Louis. And as soon as I opened that store, 3 of the 5 people that I was supplying decided to tell me that I was no longer allowed to supply them because now I'm their competitor. When originally all I wanted to do was put those cards in a spot where I could organize them so that I could supply them better. And after they told me that I couldn't supply them anymore, now I needed to find a way to create more income because like I just lost 3/5 of mine. And so now I had to run events and actually run a regular store. And then that store.
How was that compared to floor trading? How did you find the two when you think about
that? So think like one is you're stuck inside a shell. Essentially, think of it like that. In my opinion, owning a store, and I had a very small store, and it wasn't very well financed, but owning that store was like I was stuck inside of a shell. People could come and bring me stuff, but I couldn't go anywhere. Going to Grand Prix allowed me to go and get everything that my store could possibly want. Let's say there's somebody came in and they're like, hey, I need this dual land. I could always find a dual land at a Grand Prix and bring it back to the store if I wanted.
And you kind of cut off your consumer base, right? Because you're now limited to the locals. Whereas when you're going to shows, I mean, you've got potentially the entire country, right?
Right.
You know?
Yeah, it's amazing. I know there are a lot of, while I'm trading at Grand Prix, there are a lot of people that have been from their local store to get specific things for the store to bring back. And those people will do both. They'll trade up and down. So they'll trade and trade away the cards that the store doesn't want for 80%. And sometimes they'll try to trade for stuff that the store wants for even more, just depending on the person again. So I think this new rule possibly eliminates them too, or it'll make it harder. Or maybe that store will then just have to like turn all its stuff into vendors, or maybe just not go at all. I don't know.
Fascinating. So you said that your store was, 3 years, 2 years?
So my store was open for, I think, something like 6 years. But I was there for the first year And then Troll and Toad recruited me. And then I went down to Troll and Toad and left it in the hands of my girlfriend. And then it ran itself for a little while. And then once I left Troll and Toad, I opened another store in Kentucky, which was a small endeavor with me and a buddy of mine named Israel. And then I came back to St. Louis to try to salvage the store in St. Louis. And it went through a few really, really bad incidents where somebody had basically stole $20,000-ish from it. So I had to come try to fix that. And eventually I ended up selling it. But in between that time, there were a lot of good events. A lot of people like had a lot of good times at that store.
Interesting. So, just touch on this briefly and then we'll move on. But if you had to do it again, would you be in the brick and mortar business, or would you just, all things considered, would you have just, stuck to trading?
If I had to do it again, I would have opened the store to the point to where I went to Troll and Toad and then I would have closed it.
Okay.
But I would not be in the brick and mortar business because I think it's much more efficient to just travel and buy things. You also get to travel, which I guess at this point I don't really care so much for. But earlier on in my career was a lot of fun.
So I guess we can move into to questions, Chaz, which I think we've got several already.
Yeah, we have several. If you don't care fielding them, Ogre?
Oh, yeah. Whatever you guys want to do.
All right. So we have a question from one of our writers. they just want to know, how did you come up with the Ogre Box?
So the Ogre Box is essentially just the way that I let's explain it first. So not everybody knows exactly how the Ogre Box works, even though you guys explained it, I'm sure, a few times. The way that I used it is I put the cards in the order from lowest to highest of how much money I want for the specific card. It doesn't matter. It's not a flat percentage. It's not not anything specific, but it can be. And it's variable. So you don't have to stick to one thing. Sometimes I do, but sometimes it ranks up based on how the higher end stuff. So I'll start with like the low end stuff and put it in at like 20 or 35% and then go up to the higher things and put them in at more. But you guys are familiar with Dan Bok?
Of course. Yeah.
Yep. Okay. Yep.
So Dan Bok is the person that I probably have given the most Ogre Boxes to over my lifetime. And I would go up there sometimes with, I think there's one collection that I went up with, like it was an entire conversion van full of cards. And we sat for 4 days and then an extra day after a GP just selling Ogre Box after Ogre Box. And he would confirm them and take them. But I got to the point to where it was taking too long to deal with individual cards. So instead, what you do is you present all of your cards at how much you want to sell them for, and they can either yes or no them. And it makes it super easy. So you got your nickel, dime, quarter, 50-cent stack, et cetera, all the way up to however high you want to go. And then you present it to a vendor or whoever's buying it. And then they get to go through and do all the work of deciding whether or not they want it or not. And it made things super easy.
Fascinating. So I know a lot of guys, and by the way, this question came from David Schumann, our writer. Oh, wait, David's curious if the van that you're describing was the one that you broke the axle on.
Wait, which one? The one that I broke when?
apparently, David, are you saying there's been multiple vans with multiple broken axles?
Yes. I wish somebody, I've broken at least three vans, not all axles. The one that you guys are talking about, I believe, is the one that I currently have. So it's a like a Freightliner or a Sprinter van, and I drove it to California to pick up some bulk that I was picking up. And I put in way more weight than it should have ever had. So I put in 2.2 million cards, which weighs approximately 8,800 pounds. And I drove it over the mountains to get it home. And it made it somehow. And then about a week or two later, I went to another location in Ohio. And I picked up, I think it was another, like a 1.5 million card collection. And as I was coming back to St. Louis, the wheel literally came off. So I had a tire change previously. And they didn't screw the lug nuts on right. Or they screwed them on loose or whatnot. And the lug nuts came off, and the wheel I saw go ahead of me as the van started slowing down. I had Tripper driving, and luckily, if you guys don't know him, Tripper Gibson is a really good friend of mine, and he was driving last year. He drove me literally everywhere, and it was amazing. And he's just slowly gets over to the side, and we see the wheel go in front of us, and it starts bouncing off the highway. And we were going 70 or so. We couldn't have gone faster. It was definitely 70 because I got a governor on it. And we stop, and we go out the van, and we look at the thing. And I think I may have taken a picture of it and posted it on Facebook. I'm not sure.
You did.
I did. Apparently, I did. Yeah, so there's 1.5 million cards in the van at this point. There were 550,000 bulk rares. So that's approximately $55,000. And there was, I think it was 1 million Pokemon cards, which at the time, I was selling for $90,000. So there was about $150,000 that I had to leave on the side of the road because no tow truck could come and move the vehicle until I moved all of the cards.
Okay, wait a minute. So I'm just putting this vision in my head. There's literally like thousands and thousands of Pokemon cards just chilling on the side of the highway.
Yeah, millions. Over a million.
Wow.
So they're not on the highway.
That's a meme.
They're in the van on the highway.
That's a magic meme.
What'd you say?
That could be a magic meme. I mean, that's like a crazy visual. or a card game meme. Like just millions of Pokemon cards stranded on the side of the road because the truck that was delivering them just fell off.
No. So they were still in the vehicle. They weren't on the highway or anything.
Okay. I thought you said you had to leave them.
I had to leave them in the vehicle overnight. So there was no way a tow truck could move the vehicle because it was weighed down too much. So the next day when I came back to the vehicle, I had to rent a U-Haul or not a U-Haul, Penske or whatever, and me and Tripper move all the cards, at least all the Pokemon cards, over to the other vehicle. And then a tow truck could then lift the vehicle to move it.
That's unbelievable.
$4,500 later, I had an axle and a new wheel.
Wow. That's crazy. And this is – so wait, you're saying that this kind of happened a couple of times.
There have been a lot of vehicles that I have destroyed. It's not always been that one. There was a small trailer once that like we went out to look at, and the wheel was literally just rotating around with nothing holding it on. There's a picture of that on my Facebook too. My Facebook is Matthew Ogre Stevens. If anybody wants to friend me, feel free to ask me any questions you want. But on that one, luckily we had broken down about 4 miles away from the location where the company made the axles, so we could just buy another one and put it on. Which was very, very random. What are the vehicles that are broken?
Breaking vehicles with Pokemon bulk.
Yeah.
Since 20 whatever.
Tripper once backed into a trash can and broke the window out of a vehicle. That was interesting. Just shattered. It was crazy like.
Wow.
There are definitely more. I just can't remember them.
At the time these situations just didn't make sense to just like invest in like a newer vehicle, because I guess you're on the road so much, situations are changing, people are coming and going, right? Like it probably just made more sense to kind of just use
vehicle, so the vehicle, right? That the transmission, or not the, yeah, the vehicle that the wheel fell off of, the transmission also went out that same like month period of time. But that vehicle I had just purchased like 2 months earlier. So it was like the best vehicle I've ever owned, which sucks. You know, buying a new vehicle, you require like real amounts of credit and a lot of money. And I've always just put the money back in the magic cards or whatever I was buying to make more money.
For sure. I this hasn't been brought up in the chat, but I have a question, which is regarding bulk rares. This is an interesting phenomenon because that was a market that a lot of guys really, really was lucrative for a lot of people, was the bulk rare market. And I know, you know, we spoke last year at Vegas and you were telling me that the market's kind of dipped significantly. And now we're seeing places even like, you know, I mean, we don't know what's going to happen with Star City. You know, apparently this sale that they've been running, where they reduced their rates, but they're claiming it's only for the holidays and whatnot, which we'll see what happens. But you know, they've dropped down to 8 cents You know, everybody's buying. What's going on with the bulk rare market, and how do you feel? How do you feel that, you know, that sector moving forward?
All right, so there are still outlets for bulk rares. There's just not a lot of them. As far as the Star City thing, I'm under the impression it's going to go back up to 10 cents, I think February 2nd or 3rd. And this was not like, that's just what I've heard. I don't know for sure. There are other companies that buy them for good numbers. Just some of them won't buy mine because I have too many. I think that's how they worded it. I think the market is very weak. I think if you were to buy them at 5 cents always, as far as at least right now, you're still safe because there are people that'll pay.
Sorry,
seven.
Can you say that again? Just you said 7 cents.
No, if you want to buy one safely so that you can actually like make money on it, I don't think you should pay more than like 5 cents.
Got it. Okay.
But I mean, there are going to be people out there. I think currently there's still people that pay 10 cents. You just have to find them. I'm not going to tell you. I need to sell mine first. But
I mean, so I will say this. Card Kingdom is, you know, they're a client of QS. So we love those guys. They still pay 10 cents. They're one of the bigger.
Let me write that one down just in case. You know, we'll see how long it takes.
Yeah, man.
Message me later. Yeah, they clearly, you know, they buy a lot of stuff. That company is pretty awesome. And they apparently, if you guys constantly promote them and they still pay 10 cents and they're not lowering it, then, I mean, that's a great spot. So I think they also give the bonus on it. So if you want an extra 30%, they'll give you that too.
Yeah. No, we love those guys here. They're awesome. So the market is quote unquote bad, in that you just don't have enough outs for that, I guess. Like you just sitting on just, I'm assume, thousands upon maybe even millions of bulk rare.
No. I only, like this very moment, I have 44,000.
Okay. All right.
So not a lot.
But it's just hard to find places that want it. And it, you know, so I guess my question is, because you've had so much experience in direct experience with a lot of supply and inventory. Is this just, are we hitting a saturation point? Did we already hit that point? Or is it just that those cards just don't sell very well anymore, and repacks or whatever other savvy ways people have to get rid of them?
I think it's a combination of everything that you just said. So they continuously make commander decks. This is one of the big comments that I hear from at least one of the people that I used to sell a lot of this stuff to. So commander decks are essentially just commons. Like, you get every copy of everything you're getting every time. So that makes the bulk rares from at least that particular run almost worthless, but they still have that rare symbol, so they're still considered a bulk rare. So if they turn commander decks into, like, purple or a different color, then they would be worth nothing. You wouldn't even be able to sell them as a bulk rare, right?
Absolutely.
So that's definitely, like you said, saturating it or diluting it. There are a lot of companies that, you know, what do you need to be able to sell those products is basically some kind of lot that you could put on eBay or Amazon or whatever. And there's not a lot of people that want to put the time into actually creating those lots, even though you can still make money if you did it. And if you need a supply so that you can start creating those lots, you just hit me up. You like that random plug?
plug away, bud. It's no worries.
but yeah, so... I found it a lot easier to find the supply of those than to find the people that have the demand. So in essence,
we'll, and to be clear, the market mostly is for the gold symbol, correct? Like most stores require that if you want full rate, you have to send in gold symbol rare, right?
Yeah. For some reason, clearly the hunt for bulk rares, you know, you're trying to find that little bit of value, right? Nobody buys a bulk rare just to hope they get a random gold symbol card. And that's why you get people telling you, no, I won't take this one, or I won't take this quantity. You know, it's not that they don't need the bulk rare. It's that they want to find a little diamond in the rough type thing. And then, you know, buying them for me, you're going to most likely just get bulk rares. But sometimes I don't have the manpower to go through them, and I'll sell you the cards with the 25 and 50 cent cards still in them just so I can move them and buy more stuff.
So, yeah, I mean, it's really interesting because I started to view bulk rares as like a really great area because you always know what they're worth. And I remember Niels, who's a moderator here, and he's been with QS for a long time, and he would make this point, and I didn't really think about it back in the day, but he's like, listen, guys, I love bulk rares because it has a set value. I know it's always going to be worth this. There's no variance with it. So, I'm able to play within that number. And I think that's a really interesting idea, right? And I'm sure that's how you guys used to see it before the market got, started to turn on it. But it's probably really nice because you go, okay, well, I know I'm going to be able to get X, right? So I can build work.
The thing is, it's still there, as long as Card Kingdom or I think Cool Stuff still pays a dime. And I think Star City will pay a dime, as long as those people, as long as there's at least one, then that value is still solid, especially for the mid-range collector or the person that's trying to grind their area. They're still going to be able to get those bulk rares and sell them or trade them to those people that will still pay it.
We're going to do, I'll bring up one more topic, and I think we kind of have to wrap it up. This has just been crazy. I can't believe we're already an hour and 20 minutes. Like, we could just keep talking forever, but we do have to kind of wrap it up for everybody. But I guess, you've been doing this for so long, obviously you're kind of a legend as far as when it comes to the industry side of things. How are things looking for Magic in general? I mean, you started out in, late 90s, 2000s. You've seen the game go through all of its ups and downs and where we're at now and the reprints and the supply and all these things. So how do you feel, what do you think of the industry as far as Magic, like where we're at and where it is going, where it's going forward?
So I think it's still very solid, very amazing. There's a huge amount of, there's still huge Grand Prix, like full of people. I don't follow the numbers well enough to see any kind of trends because I'm not looking at it. I'm looking at the cards in front of me. I really dislike the idea of the Grand Prix thing because that affects me more than everything. So I'm a bit skewed in that aspect. I think Magic is still going to go strong. I think the reprints are a bit insane. I don't think you need to force so many reprints down. You need to slowly do that. Slowing down production of the expensive stuff will create a demand in itself, which will keep a spark alive, basically. I think that that's important.
How about trading, man? Do you think trading is still a thing? Does the game still have that allure to be a trading card game as it used to?
I know, that's so weird. Like, that's another point that I didn't get to talk too much about. It is a trading card game. It's so far-fetched to think that, or so weird to think that you could start to eliminate a specific kind of trade. But yeah, it's still a trading card game. It'll always be that as long as they're not just printing, hey, go buy this 100 cards. They're all the same. Then it's just a living game, right?
Right. Well, cool. Chaz, we have any last question?
Doesn't look like it. Apparently Jeremy is on his way over. Ogre. He was taking a drive over. Apparently,
he's coming to my house, but
I don't know. I don't think so.
Come and message me. Come over. Oh, maybe you got a message.
All right. Because he apparently, with the amount of stories, we could have had like a 12-hour marathon podcast.
If you guys want to keep going, I'm down. I don't care.
I've actually got Jet. And I think, yeah. Chaz, we're kind of, but we try and keep these. I mean, listen, what we do is we typically do, about an hour.
We can definitely have you back.
And we'll have you back, man. Yeah. We'll definitely have you back on, and I'm more than happy to have you on. It's great, man. So listen, dude, it was awesome. Like I said, you're a legend to many of us. And for those that don't know, I'm sure they've learned a ton. And, listen, I guess we'll just have to see moving forward. I'll say this. I'm going to be bummed if, people can't go to Grand Prix and see you, kind of out there doing your thing. I mean, that was kind of, that was part of the Grand Prix experience was the floor traders. That was just another aspect of the whole thing. And
I mean, it's been a thing since GPs were like 500 people.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's always been a thing. And I mean, like I said, I was really shocked. We're going to try to push to have CFB back on. And that's definitely going to be at the top of our list of what we're going to ask. Because like I said earlier, I did not get an inclination they didn't give off any kind of vibe that they were going to change things so drastically. I mean, that just kind of seems like.
You also never know how drastic it's going to be until it happens. So,
right. I was just saying from when they were taking on this kind of responsibility, they were pretty adamant about them not changing a whole lot. You know, and they said that they're always very open to feedback. So, I mean, if it's any one thing to change one of their policies that they put into place, it's feedback. So they get enough of it, they'll change it.
Yeah.
All right, man. Well, again, thank you so much. Like I said, I think people learned a bunch. And if they didn't know what floor trading was or how it worked, man, you definitely illuminated it. So I appreciate it, man. Yeah. We'll definitely going to have you on again.
There's a lot more to talk about. So we'll definitely have you back on, Ogre. Thank you so much again. Really appreciate you having your insight and your time on here.
Yeah, absolutely. Anytime you guys want, just let me know.
Sounds cool, great. Man.
All right.
Well, that's going to wrap it up for this cast. Really quickly, if you know, folks have questions or they want to get a hold of you, what's the easiest way to do that if you're actually open to doing that?
Yeah, just Facebook, Matthew Ogre Stevens. I'm the really giant looking guy in the picture.
All right, sounds good. Where can they get a hold of you, Tark?
Yeah, I'm at @the_Tark on Twitter. You can find me over at the MTG Finance Central Facebook page. I do some admin work with those guys over there. And, of course, I work with QS.
Sounds good. Yeah, you can find my work on QS. I write insider articles, cover PTs. I pretty much do it all. And if you really need me, you know where to find me, at the QS Insider Discord. All right, folks, that's going to wrap it up for tonight. Thank you so much again. This has been a great cast. We'll see you soon, Ogre.
Cool. Talk to you later.
Take care, everyone.